Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from Thunder Bay, Canada, and on a deep-sea cargo ship called the Federal Yukina. My good friend, Captain Annan's the master, and he's taking a cargo of 22,000 tons of wheat to Marseille, France. I wish I was going with him, but I'd like to thank him for his hospitality on his ship tonight. Also, we've got Ronnie Chepsik. Ronnie Chepsik will do the show from Los Angeles tonight. And I'll tell you something, we've got a great show. We've got a great show tonight. The broadcast brings you Bob Fitzpatrick and John Land, authors of Betrayal, Whitey Bulger, and the FBI agent who fought to bring him down. More about them and their book in just a few moments. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director, publisher. He's a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project is the just-released documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books, www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is a leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Get out there and buy his books, and be sure to check out his documentary DVDs. You won't be disappointed. Also, be sure to visit his website at www.ronchepsik.com. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Now, here's Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio of my co-host and friend, Willie Hareb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist in Thunder Bay, Canada, which is also my hometown, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he is a contributing writer to several trade publications. Last year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. Volume 2 is coming out next year. And this summer, he'll be publishing another book about the famous Gondola shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport on Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. Our book, Movers and Mavericks, is selling like ice-cold beer on a hot day in Coney Island. Thanks for that very much. Well, Ronnie, it's going to be a great show, so we invite our listeners to stay tuned, and we're just going to have a wonderful show with these two guys. Just before we reach into our mailbag and read some mail we received over the last couple of weeks, I'd like to thank all our listeners out there from around the world, that's around the globe, for tuning into Crime Beat. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up about our program. You know, we're averaging over 130,000 listeners every week and in over 100 countries. And that's certainly something to cheer about. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artist First Radio Network, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony, for making the show possible. Also, a special thanks to the Ryan Brothers for allowing us to use their music as our theme song. Like I said many times, Ronnie Boy, Internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Well, Ronnie, now here is this week's mailbag. This one is from Sharon of El Paso, Texas, who writes, "Your interview with Chris Kyle and his autobiography called American Sniper was a visceral and fascinating look into a one-man war machine. I guess it takes a special kind of person to pull the trigger knowing you're snuffing out someone's life." Now, this one's from Denica of Spokane, Washington. Denica writes, "I don't know about you, but I think killing someone from 2,000 yards, recording the kill, and publishing it, it's kind of creepy. Even though some think Chris Kyle is a hero, I think it shows that mankind is still a predator and not likely to change its stripes soon. Wow. Any remarks to those there, Ronnie?
Yeah, I think Chris has a very strong sense of duty, and he is a hero, and he didn't take what he did, lightly. And I think the book was sort of a catharsis for him. I think it really helped to resolve a lot of issues he had after serving four tours in Afghanistan. And, a lot of people are interested. The book has sold 500,000 copies.
It's amazing.
John Land, who's another writer on the show tonight, could really identify with that, right?
Not at all.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he was a very, very, very interesting guest. And his book proves that there's a lot of people out there that are interested in it. Well, Ronnie, hey, tell us, what have you been up to? And hey, what are you doing in L.A. tonight?
Right. Well, last week we were in New York for the Museum of American Gangster. We had the preview of Frank Matthews' story, and it went extremely well. This week we're in Hollywood, man. We're going to Hollywood. I took Ike with me, the subject, of course, Sergeant Smack, and we're at the Hollywood Show, www.hollywoodshow.com. And I'm starting to call Ike, Hollywood Ike. He's starting to call me Cadillac Ron. And we're going to have a great time out here. We'll be here for 2 days signing books, meeting people. Yeah. There's like 5 to 10,000 people going through here every day. So it's going to be a really great experience.
Well, that's great, Ronnie, and I'm sure it'll be a success. Good luck to you. Well, Ronnie, you want to give our listeners out there in that wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show.
Right. We begin, and I'm really excited about this, a two-part series on Frank Matthews, the Frank Matthews story, which I call the most intriguing story in the history of organized crime. And we're going to have sources from our documentary on federal prosecutor, DEA, a couple of his homeboys are going to talk about his life in the first episode. And in the second episode, we're going to talk about his mysterious disappearance. As you know, Willie, he's been gone 40 years, and there hasn't been a trace, nothing. What you picture?
Amazing.
They saw him at an ATM machine. You knew he was around. He was coming back to Boston. But Frank Matthews has disappeared off the face of the earth.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. I think he's going to show up sooner or later. Well, Ronnie, as you know, the beat to crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. And this one is rap sheet item number one, Dateline, April 17th, Rome, Italy. Girls in nun costumes stripped for Silvio Berlusconi at a bunga bunga party. Hey, Ronnie, a witness at Silvio Berlusconi's trial earlier this week said that he witnessed having sex with this underage prostitute, testifying earlier that also she saw two young women in non-costumes with black tunics, white veils, and crosses stripping in front of the then prime minister. Hey, Ronnie, hey, this sounds like your kind of party. What's your take on this?
Yeah, I'm an organizing bunga bunga party here for the 1% percenters here in the United States, Berlusconi's great friend. But, you know, I told you, if it looks like a pervert, walks like a pervert, it is a pervert. And we had, Berlusconi figured out this guy, I mean, he has so much power that he thought he could do he could do anything, but I'm just wondering what the fantasy is with black tunics and white veils and dresses and nuns. It's really strange, right? Hollywood couldn't make it up.
Well, it's pretty titillating, I tell you. It's like the modern-day Sodom and Gomorrah, I'm telling you.
Right.
Now, here is this week's... It's amazing. Well, it just proves he's young at heart, right?
Right, right. Well, he always belonged in the old Rome, in B.C., just before we had the fiddle, you know, with Nero and Caligula and all that. That's where he really belonged, not in modern-day society.
Right on, right on. Well, Ronnie, we've got two guests, and we're going to forego the second rap sheet, if you don't mind. Crime Beat's featured guests tonight are Robert Bob Fitzpatrick and John Land, co-authors of the best-selling book titled Betrayal, Whitey Bulger and the FBI Agent Who Fought to Bring Him Down, a poor kid from the slums. Bob Fitzpatrick grew up to become a stellar FBI agent and challenged the country's deadliest gangsters, relentless in his desire to catch, prosecute, and convict the infamous and deadly Whitey Bulger. Fitzpatrick fought the nation's most determined cop, gangster battle since Melvin Purvis hunted, confronted, and killed John Dillinger. In his crusade to bring Bulger to justice, Fitzpatrick not only faced the cold-blooded killer Whitey Bulger, but also corrupt FBI agents, along with the political cronies and enablers from Boston to Washington. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Runny.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Bob Fitzpatrick, John Lamb.
Thanks for having us, Runny.
Great. So how is the book doing? What kind of response you get? What do your old colleagues at the FBI think about your book?
John?
Well, it's you're the FBI. They want to know about your colleagues, what the FBI people actually think about it.
Right. I'll get the literary view of the book from John. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, the book's doing fine. As a matter of fact, it's running pretty high on Amazon and also up here in New England. It's basically a crime story in New England, much like Capone was a story in Chicago.
Right.
This guy's a dead killer. He's a real bad guy who murdered over 19, 20 people and was with about his own gang. The Winter Hill Gang, if you want to call them that.
Right.
And they, between them, they probably killed over 60 people. So
right.
The story starts way back in 1976 and ends last year with his capture in Santa Monica.
Right. Well, we'll get into the story, but you still never answered my question about what your colleagues think at the FBI. What kind of feedback are you getting?
John, are you there?
Yeah. That question is for you, Bob.
Oh, sorry about that. You know, not everybody's happy. Nobody's happy when you're criticizing an organization like the FBI.
Right.
Look at the Secret Service right now, the grief that they're taking. And, of course, you know, nobody likes to be in that position. But this case was tried in court over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I testified in most of the cases, over 10 cases.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, in the courts, in the appellate courts particularly, mm-hmm. the FBI was found wanting, and they were fined over $150 million. So,
wow.
You know, getting back to that, they actually, I hate to use the term guilty, but you know, they were tagged with the crime, and they were tagged with protecting two gangsters, you know, two
right.
really bad guys who mm-hmm. Who caused a lot of problems and done a lot of murders and so forth, and they were accused of that. So
right.
they're not happy, but
right.
on the other hand, the good agents, and there are a lot of good agents, you know, they appreciate the fact that the bad agents took the heat and are in jail right now.
Does the FBI work like the CIA, where you need their official okay to write a book? I mean, I know I have a friend from the CIA that did a book, and you know, they go over it with a fine tooth comb. Is that the case with the FBI?
No, it's not.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Bob. Oh, well, I was going to say the thing that we have in this book, Ronnie, is
right.
everything we're saying has been supported by court documentation. So
right.
since all this material that we're quoting from and actually excerpting in the book, and we've actually presented some confidential memos that have never been seen by the public before, the reason
mm-hmm.
we're able to do that is they were entered into testimony and evidence in court. So we're not saying anything in this book that Bob
mm-hmm.
hasn't testified to in court or that we can't independently corroborate. One of the things I think your listeners and anyone who picks up a trail is going to be impressed by is the fact that even though it's a first-person memoir, even though this is told in Bob Fitzpatrick's voice, and in that respect it's very much a catharsis, just like your analysis
right.
of American Sniper, which I think is
right.
spot on, it is
right.
a catharsis. But unlike the vast majority of first-person memoirs, we supply
mm-hmm.
copious notes, end notes, mm-hmm. to support every single claim that we make in the book. Because some of these claims are pretty controversial. They're pretty salacious. There are things
right.
we are saying in this book that have never been said before about Whitey Bulger and the entire crime-riddled, blood-soaked era.
Right. Well, John, people are waiting for the trial. You know, this is going to be one of the most sensational trials in organized crime history. Will you have any impact on that trial, what you guys wrote about in this book? Is there anything in there that will be used by the prosecution or the defense to further their position in court?
That's a great question, better answered by Bob than myself.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good question. And what we've been careful to do, even now, is not prejudge Bulger. After all, you know, even though he's a thug, and we don't call him a thug, his own guys call him a thug and call him a bloodthirsty gangster. So all we do is just report the facts, and we report the testimony. But also, I mean, I lived the case. You know, I was an agent throughout the whole period there. In fact, I was in charge of most of the investigation, and so firsthand, I mean, I could tell you the guy's a bad guy, and that's been testified to over and over again. With regard to his trial in November, it's set for November 5th, 2012. Obviously, no one wants to regurgitate that whole bad era, but unfortunately, I think some of it's going to be exposed again. And obviously, he will now take the stand. And so Bulger's going to either cop out to the killings, and as I said, there is at least 19 documented, or he's going to say that the Bureau protected him, which has been his mantra all along.
Right. Are there a lot of nervous people in the FBI? I'm not relishing the fact that the trial is going to start in November of this year.
Well, you know, there's nervous people inside and outside the FBI. Remember, this guy dealt with attorneys. He dealt with people in different agencies and so forth. And he's a deal maker. He's a con man. He's
probably
a con man.
He knows where the bodies are buried, too, right? He knows where the bodies are buried.
Well, yeah, and his guys told the FBI and the state police where the bodies were. And they dug him up.
Now, John, I think your background is interesting. You've had like 30 novels, and you have a really interesting female Texas Ranger, Catalin Strong, and all that. This was your first foray into nonfiction, right?
Excellent. Yes, it
is
Ron. First one.
Right. And so, you know, I admire you as a fiction writer, but I made the book that you did all this research. And able to put this story together because, you know, it's an amazing story, but it's still, you have to document everything, which is not like exactly like fiction. Was there any particular challenges in doing this book for you?
That's a great question, and I think the biggest challenge, well, you just illuminated one of the biggest challenges, so I don't have to repeat that, but here as a writer is what my job, or what any nonfiction writer's job is when you're doing playing the role of the second banana, the person who is assembling the material, and that is to capture the voice of the hero. Because every scene, everything you learn is coming from Bob. So I needed to find his voice in the same way that when I'm writing my Catelyn Strong Texas Ranger novels, I'm looking for her voice. The difference is, just what you said, I'm totally making up and fabricating Catelyn Strong's voice. She can be whatever I want her to be. But with Bob Fitzpatrick, he's a real person. I had to, you know, getting to know him as a person was just as important as researching and getting to know all the material. And one of the things I am most gratified about, probably one of the great things I've ever accomplished in my career, is when Bob himself has told me so often that it sounds like him, when other people who are close to him can't even tell what parts I wrote and what parts were basically dictated from past things that came from Bob. So that is the biggest challenge. What was that, Ronnie?
It was a writer, the fact that he captured the place so well on that. Bob's background, I that, it's a big background, isn't it? I mean, he could easily have gone the other way, you know, given his background. He had a tough background, neglected. He was placed in social services.
You know, that's such a great point, because
I'll have to respond to that.
Bob, you want to talk about your upbringing in the home?
Yeah. You want me to do that?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's what Ronnie wanted.
Well, you know, as a child in New York, growing up in New York, I was born in a welfare hospital, actually. And my parents had a lot of problems. And so at an early date, I was put into an orphanage in New York City. And stayed there basically throughout my early years before going into the military and going through college and finally grad school and so forth and joining the FBI. That was an extraordinary experience. My wife and I chat about it a lot. It's an experience that very few people have today. The home, we had 1,000 kids. We had 1,000 boys and girls. It was a very regimented, disciplined type of home. Corporal punishment was the norm. And basically, we did everything by the numbers. It's not the way I would like to see a kid raised, and certainly didn't raise my own children. I have 4 children. And, you know, having been through that, I have been successfully in raising my own, all of whom have graduated from college and have gone on to grad school and so forth. So the home helped me, I think, in a disciplinary way. And the home, the orphanage, also helped me to put up with a lot of stuff that I think most people would not have gone through.
Go ahead, John.
If I can add something, you know, when we're talking about, to me, that is, when I first sat down with Bob over 3 years ago, the first thing I knew was that this was one of these rare stories that was nonfiction but read like fiction, very much like in Cold Blood, the great Truman Capote, you know, seminal story. Mm-hmm. But to me, the defining moment when he started telling me about his upbringing, you have this basically an orphan growing up in an abusive situation, you know, corporal punishment, and two things stuck out immediately to me. One was the fact that late at night, the nun who lived in the hall would leave her door open, and so the boys like Bob could hear the old-time radio shows, one of which was "This Is Your FBI," and that's where Bob's dream to become an FBI agent was born. Now, of course, the dream becomes a nightmare, but then we have the vindication. But even more powerful than that, there's a scene early in the book where two counselors, to get information out of these little boys, make them hang from the steam pipes until they fall off and then they get beaten. Bob was the last one still hanging on. That image is an image we come back to in the book the way I would if it was a novel. Because what happened to Bob in Boston when he was hung out to dry, to use the metaphor again, by his own people who stopped him from doing to Dewitt Bulger what should have been done. He should have been closed as an informant and arrested. He was hung from the steam pipes again. But the difference, Ronnie, the difference this time was he wasn't an 8-year-old boy being bullied. He was a stellar, celebrated FBI agent, and this time he could fight back, and that's what he did.
Well, you're right. He was celebrated. He played a key role. Bob played a key role in the the famous Mississippi burning investigation, and I understand, you know, from the book, you recovered the rifle that was used in the Martin Luther King assassination, and that ultimately, led to the arrest of James Earl Ray. So you did have, you know, some really highs before you entered the Boston office, right, Bob?
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, let me back up. Prior to coming to the FBI, I was a psychiatric social worker. Mm-hmm. And I work with gangs in New York. I used to bring the kids to court and plead them out and so forth. And so I learned a lot on the streets in New York, in Harlem, Bed-Stuy, some of the more dangerous parts. And so when I came into the Bureau, they sent me down to Mississippi and to New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And they needed people who could do civil rights investigations, which I immediately got involved in. So I was undercover in the Burning of Mississippi. I don't know if you ever saw that movie, Burning of Mississippi.
Oh, yeah, right.
We actually handled the bombings in Mississippi.
Right.
And so I was undercover for about a year and a half and was able to bring down some of the top Ku Klux Klan guys, Sam Bowers and so forth. And then I went on to Memphis. I stayed down there. I had the duty night supervisor of the Martin Luther King case, where King had come to Memphis on a civil rights matter and was assassinated by James Earl Ray. I found the weapon, brought it back to the Bureau, and out of that we got fingerprints off it, and we were able to arrest James Earl Ray.
Right.
And following that, I had a lot of different things. Abscam in Miami, I had a lot of organized crime stuff, Marcello in New Orleans, and so forth. So I didn't come into Boston naive. I didn't pull off the turnip truck, if you want to put it that way.
Hey, Roddy, I got a quick question for Bob,
Willie,
if you don't mind.
Let's start off the second session. We'll take a station break, and then
lead
into the question, and we'll get into the Boston office, the nightmare of the Boston office.
You bet. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Shepsick and Will Ribb. Our special guests this evening are Bob Fitzpatrick and John Land, authors of Betrayal, Whitey Bulger, and the FBI agent who fought to bring him down. Now back to Ron and our guests.
Thank you, Willie. And we are with Bob Fitzpatrick and John Land, as Willie said, and the authors of Betrayal, the excellent book on Whitey Bulger. If you guys have a website devoted to the book or devoted to each of you?
There is johnlandbooks.com, and there's
johnlandbooks.com.
Very original, you know, something.
Right,
you
right. But it is original because your first name is John, right? It's John
Land. Yeah, J-O-N.
Right, yeah. J-O-N, right, right.
Yeah, so original. And that's my
John
name.
Land, right, book stuff. How about you?
Hello?
Yeah, Bob?
Yeah, you're breaking up, guys, on my phone.
Oh, okay. How about you get the website?
John, you got that?
Yeah, Bob doesn't have a website. We're hopefully by the trial we'll have one up.
Right. Okay. It's going to be a big guarantee because of the interest in Bolger with the trial. And you could get the book at Amazon and everywhere else, right? Traditional places, the book, right? And internationally, because a lot of our listeners are overseas, they could order the book as well on that. But let's get back to our interview. When did you enter the FBI? When did you enter the FBI, Bob? What year?
87.
Okay, and when did you make the move to the Boston office?
When did I get there?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I was assigned 1980. Right. And I was assigned as what they call a special assistant special agent in charge. In other words, I was number two man in the office. And actually, you know, just walked into a situation that was festering. And in fact, John and I captured that moment in the book, which is quite unusual. Mm. It explains in the book the deep problems that were occurring in the office through Bulger, Flemmy, and a bunch of other people who were using the Bureau to close down their competitors and take over the mob in Boston.
But, was this common knowledge within the Boston office that this was going on, or were they naive about it?
They what? Say it again.
I said, was this common knowledge in the Boston office that Bulger was a phony and he was manipulating, the office for his own gain? Or were they naive about it?
No, what happens is informants are by necessity secret, and no one's supposed to know who they are. And that was kind of one of the problems at first, because the agents couldn't tell the law enforcement people, the state police and the cops and so forth, that these two guys, Bulger and Flemmy, were their guys. whereas everybody else in Boston and New England saw these two guys, Bulger and Flemmi, as really bad guys, and what are they hanging around with these agents for? Mm-hmm. So that conundrum became a huge problem in terms of not being able to explain what the problem really was. But disregarding that, you know, the guys, Bulger and Flemmi, should not have been protected. They should not have been allowed to do the things they did. And, of course, that's why the two agents and the other people got in trouble, and the agents in jail right now.
Right.
Because he his own
John, there were two other important important characters in the story on the FBI side, John Connolly and John Morris. Can you explain who they were and how they related to the story that you wrote?
Sure. When I arrived, I had some knowledge that there was a problem, but I had no knowledge how deep this problem was. When I met everybody in the office, I met two people, a guy named Morris and a guy named Conley. Conley is a street agent. He's a special agent. And his job was to handle Bulger. He's the guy that Bulger reported to. Morris is his supervisor. Morris is the guy that runs the organized crime squad, and they report to me. I'm the manager of the organized crime program throughout New England, Maine, New Hampshire, Mass, and Rhode Island. And so, ostensibly, Conley is the guy who's bringing in the information, and this is information that Bulger is supposed to be given in taking down the mafia, the Italian mafia. Yeah. For of any term, we labeled Bulger's gang the Irish mafia. And so what was going on is that Bulger is being credited with doing all this stuff against the Italian guys. But after a fashion, after a time, I'd say about a year or so, I began to learn that, in fact, that was hype, that he was not doing that at all, and, in fact, could not be trusted. And so when I went out to interview him at his home, what I got was a guy who's simply egotistic, untrustful, bragging about how tough he is, how he was in jail, he was in Alcatraz, he was in Leavenworth. He did this, he did that. And finally, I braced him and I said, hey, what are you doing for us? What are you doing for the FBI? And I reminded him that he was an informant. And then at that point, being an Irish guy, he didn't want to be labeled as an informant. And he kind of bristled and it got, you know, a little nasty. But I kept on reminding him that, look, you know, you work for me. You know, your job is to get me information. And so far, you're not doing that. Okay. And so, to make a long story short, I left the interview, the interrogation, and I decided I can't trust this guy. This is a guy who's not willing to testify. This is a guy who says he has his own informants, which is taboo as far as I'm concerned. And then I went back and reported to my boss that you know, we can't keep this guy on any longer. We got to close him. I mean, this is not a guy that I want working for me, and he's a guy that I can't trust. And so, under normal circumstances, Bulger, Flemmi would be closed, which means that they would be terminated as informants, and we would not be in this problem today if that happened.
John Land, explain why this obsession with the Italian mafia. Why were they so, you know, and so we're getting them to the point where they were able to excuse Whitey Bulger, you know, and the evil
that's
things that
question.
He was involved with.
That's a great question, and it comes down to J. Edgar Hoover. With the fall of communism, basically, when communism was no longer deemed to be a huge threat internally, the FBI had to turn their attention to something. Hoover loved enemies. That's what made him what he was. So the Italian mafia, and this was true of the Bobby Kennedy also, he was involved as Attorney General in making in targeting the mafia, making them public enemy literally number one, not just in Boston, but all over the country. It was in Boston where the predecessors of Connolly and Morris, Paul Rico and Dennis Condon, almost began the whole thing, where literally, and here's what it comes down to, the end justifies the means. And the reason why, Ronnie and Will, to get to your exact question, it was political. Because all these agents saw nailing the Italian mob as their meal ticket to promotion, commendations, bonuses. This was the way they could make their bones. And it also explains why. It's because what Bob's, that question you asked Bob before about, you know, about why, how this happened as far as protected informants was well taken. Because the bottom line is that office, it wasn't just one or two rogue agents who were responsible here. Bob Fitzpatrick, in his efforts over the course of 5 years in Boston, almost six, the highest-ranking FBI officials in Washington were all made aware of what was going on, the fact that Bulger was killing his informants. Men who could have given up Bulger once and for all were murdered by Bulger because of leaks within the FBI. The heads of the FBI crime division in Washington knew about this. The head of the organized crime strike force in New England, Jeremiah O'Sullivan, knew this. The attorney general, the U.S. attorney of the state of Massachusetts, Bill Weld, later went on to become governor, knew this. They all knew it because Bob told them. There are reports that we cite and quote from and show you inside betrayal. And yet, nothing was done. And it goes to the question you just asked. Why? Right. Because all these people had been in bed with Bulger as an informant for so long, were so dependent on him. If they had acknowledged that Bob Fitzpatrick was right, their entire careers would have crumbled. And you know, when I look at the Penn State scandal, when I think about the Catholic Church scandal, it's the same thing. They go same in, pattern. They get in same so pattern. Deep, they can't get out. And that's what happened. These people in Boston and in Washington had dug themselves a hole so deep that they couldn't find the way out. And what happened to Bob when he went to Boston? He fell into that hole, but was the only person who could see the light at the top.
And the only thing they thought they can do was shoot the messenger, right? And so they marginalized Bob.
I was parachuted into Boston and killed in action.
Great way of putting it.
Well, it's what happened.
And they marginalized you. What do they do to you? They take away your office? I mean, how did the FBI go about
it? What actually happened was, when I started filing the complaints, some of them went pretty high, but like John explained, he's absolutely right. You know, nobody wanted to lose their pension. Nobody wanted to get in trouble that way. And plus, how do you explain using the bad guy, I mean the baddest of the guys, to be your good guy? And of course, that was Bulge's big thing, that he was pretending to be an informant, to be a trustful person, and so forth. At the time, he was building his own empire. He was actually eradicating the Irish guys, not the Italian guys.
He was using the establishment to do that, right?
Absolutely.
Right.
Well, it's probably one of the most unique crimes in the United States ever. You know, it was a national disgrace. I mean, it's still, you know, the question you asked was great, but the thing is, we don't know the answer even yet, because we don't know who the puppeteer was, you know. We don't know who's pulling the strings behind the scenes. And I think that's still prevalent today.
We don't know that.
But we do know one thing. We know that from the time Bob Fitzpatrick recommended that Whitey Bulger be closed and an informant and targeted as a criminal, that was in March of 1981. From that point until the time Bob left the Boston office of the FBI, Bulger is now, we'll say alleged. I'm not sure if that's really needs to be said, but I'll say it anyway. He allegedly killed a minimum of 14 people who didn't have to die. Four of those were FBI informants that Bob Fitzpatrick was using to give him Whitey Bulger. And as I said before, they were all murdered based on information leaked back to Bulger from inside the FBI. And those leaks didn't just come from John Connolly and John Morris. As you're going to see in Betrayal, we named some names that have never been named before as responsible.
Right. Well, that's really amazing. Here we are calling Bossier a thug, and we should be calling him the Brain. We have a segment later on Arnold Rothstein, who's called the Brain. We should be calling him the Brain instead of the thug, right?
He's a bright guy. I'll give him that. He's intelligent, but he's also stupid, you know, in many ways, like most of these guys are.
Mm, right.
And they get too egotistical. They get too big for their britches.
Mm.
And like he did, he took over a couple of the people to his own gratification. But on the other hand, there were a lot of smart people that were deluded and defrauded by this guy. I mean, you know, he had a lot of people on his side during that time. Even when I was telling my guys that he's a bad guy, they were still thinking that he's not as bad a guy as I'm saying, and I became the bad guy. You know, I'm the guy that, like you said before, they killed the messenger.
Right.
I'm the guy all of a sudden that's in the hot seat, you know, trying to prove that this guy's a bad guy, and I've already done it. I've already charged the guy with four murders. He murdered four of my informants. And so, as ludicrous as it sounds, it's an enigma. I got to tell you, it's something that I hope we'll never see again.
Right. Well, let's do a station break. Let's take a station break. Get back to our fascinating interview.
You bet. You bet. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification again. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Shepsick and Will Reb. Our very special guests this evening are Robert Fitzpatrick, that's Bob Fitzpatrick, and John Land.
Thank
now
you,
back to Ron,
back
Robert,
with,
and John.
Robert Fitzpatrick and John Land on the trail. And the book is a great read. It's a stimulating discussion. John Land has a website, J-O-N, for John Land, A-L-A-N-D. And you can get the book on Amazon and your bookstores. And as I said, we highly recommend it. So you finally couldn't take it anymore, right? I mean, you reached a point where no one was listening. You were getting marginalized, and so you had to make a decision, right?
Well, you know, Ron, my family came first. You know, my
boys and girls and
my wife came first. When it started affecting them, that was too much for me. I said, hey, you know, you guys could do whatever the hell you want to do, but you're not going to ruin my family. You're not going to do anything that puts them in jeopardy and harms them. At the same time, of course, you know, there's always the fear in yourself, in myself.
Right.
But once it transmitted to them, that was too much. I'll never forget that, and I'll never forgive them for that.
Yeah, Ronnie, I got a quick question too here. A quick one for Bob. You know, you've got four kids, four grown-up kids, Bob. And what you know about the FBI and what you've experienced with all the corruption? If one of your kids came to you and said, "Hey, Dad, I want to join the FBI," how would you counsel them?
Well, my two boys, one guy's an attorney. I talked him out of it. You know, my two girls, and my other guy's a techie. He's into high tech stuff. But my two girls are into the psychology. One graduates next month, as a matter of fact, as a psychologist, and the other one's in pre-med. So my advice to anybody going into the Bureau, into the FBI, all the officers are not like Boston. I could tell you that flat out. And it is a good job. But you have to understand that there's a protocol and that it's a quasi-military group. And when they give you orders, you know, you get the orders, you got to take them. And so if you can't do that kind of thing, then it's not a good job.
Right.
On the other hand, I think we had more discretion when I was younger, when I was a younger agent, than when I did as getting on in the Bureau. And so when I tried to close Bossier, when I tried to stop him from being an informant, I quite frankly thought that was the right thing to do. And I still do, obviously. But I'd never realized the blowback that I would get. And that still affects me to this day.
Have they cleaned the Boston office up? Is it a normal functioning FBI office? Or are there still problems there?
I'm going to stand on my First Amendment on that one.
Refuse
well,
to
John,
answer.
You don't have to stand on the First Amendment. What do you say?
No, I get to say whatever I want. And
that's right.
And this is such a great question. There's a whole story going on right now about a crime boss. I think his name is Rosati, Stephen Rosati.
Rosati, yeah.
And apparently, and I'll say this so Bob doesn't have to. Apparently, and this is not according to me, this is according to the Boston Globe, Boston Herald, Associated Press, Fox Television out of Boston, Fox 25. Apparently, it's the same thing all over again. The FBI is protecting this guy, Rosati, because he's giving up other... Again, it's the same thing where they're enabling his criminal enterprise in order that he give them... because he's doing stuff they need him to do. And it's... So have they learned their lesson? I think I'm of two minds. One, I look at the FBI as the FBI that Bob experienced, the FBI that screwed up 9/11, right, which could have been prevented if they had listened to their own agents, the FBI that screwed up anthrax, the FBI that screwed up Richard Jewell, the Olympic bombing in 1984, led to his suicide or his death. But then there's the FBI that almost every month a terrorist group in this country gets broken up because the FBI infiltrated them and prevented them from getting explosives from somebody who was real. So, you know, I mean, the Olympic Park, but, you know, the people they've intercepted coming over the Canadian border, the people, the plots and lives that the FBI has saved by being the greatest crime organization in the world. And by the way, Bob didn't give himself enough credit a few minutes ago with a question you asked him about his own children. But the fact is, he is still one of the biggest cheerleaders the FBI has. He still loves the FBI the way you love a child who didn't come out exactly the way you wanted him to. And in that respect, I think that says more about his character and his personality compared to the people, because it wasn't an organization that hurt Bob, that stopped Bob Fitzpatrick from succeeding in Boston with his mandate of bringing down Whitey Bulger. It was individuals lost in their own pursuit of glory and their own delusions that did it.
Right.
Can you blame the entire organization? To a degree, you can. But the fact is the FBI remains the greatest crime-fighting organization in the world probably ever. It does not excuse any of the mistakes they've made or the lives they've cost. And as Bob said before, this is not John Lennon and Bob Fitzpatrick making this stuff up. This is Boston District Court in repeated cases where the FBI, I'll give you an example, in the Salvati case, they were fined over $100 million, and that wasn't random. It was $1 million for every year four defendants were falsely imprisoned. Two of those defendants died. Two of them are still alive today. So it's kind of, you know, they can't enjoy the money. And Bob's final informant, a marijuana dealer, a small-time guy named John McIntyre, which is where we opened the book with his torture murder by Bulger. He was, he was the last informant murdered in 1984.
Right.
But you know, the FBI didn't kill him. It was the rogue element of the FBI, which was pervasive in the Boston office, and we just can't blame. Hopefully they've learned, and hopefully they'll continue to do 95-98% good. Does that excuse the 2% or 5% bad? No, it doesn't, because these people who died because they didn't listen to Bob should still be alive.
We're almost finished here, and I had one or two last questions here. The Bulger trial is coming up. What's your take on it? How significant is it going to be? What's going to come out? Are there going to be any bombshells coming out of that trial?
The trial is going to be set for November 5th.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as bombshells, everybody's looking for the figurative grenades being thrown. But right now, people are saying that Bulger is going to cop out, you know, that he'll make a deal somehow.
Make a deal.
I can't imagine what deal he could make, but, you know, there's that. The second thing is that he has a chance to negate all of the information that the wise guys, the hitmen, Marijuana, Flemmi, Salemi, the Italian wise guys and so forth, who dimed him when he was on the lam, if you will. He gets a chance now to possibly set them straight, which may in fact mean that they perjured themselves, if in fact that's what happened. So there's a lot of stuff around that. And of course, there's a lot of stuff around the people who helped him, you know, the guys who protected him, the people who made him the bad guy that he became. And my personal feeling on that is that he's going to claim that, you know, you made me a monster, you the government. You made me the monster that I became, because that's what Connolly said, who was the agent. You know, the FBI agent used that as a defense before he went to jail and basically said, you know, you guys made me do all this. You made me the monster. And so, you know, a lot of information that's brand new. For instance, he wrote an autobiography that's going to be exposed. In fact, he wrote two of them. He wrote one in 1995, and he wrote one in Santa Monica last year. And so there's a lot of evidence and a lot of testimony that's going to come out that no one can foretell. You know, we don't know if that's going to be covered up. We don't know if that's going to be not allowed.
So it's going to be an exciting exciting time.
Exciting
November.
Time, right?
I mean, and anybody that loves true crime, that loves organized, you know, the gossip on organized crime and developments, they're going to be in for really something on that trial. So we're all looking forward. We're going to have to wrap it up. We're going to have to wrap it up there.
Okay.
Bob and John. And once again, we had Patrick's story. Show.
Yeah, well, thanks for that. Thanks, Ronnie. Thanks, Bob. And special thanks to John Latt. Hey, Ronnie, what an interview. We needed at least 5 or 6 hours with these guys. So it was just fascinating.
We'll come back in November for you with these guys, and we'll talk about the trial. How's that sound?
Hey, way to go. It's a date, fellas. It's a date. What did you learn about our program tonight?
What did we learn about it?
Yeah, talking to Ronnie. What did Ronnie tell the listeners what you learned about our program with John and Bob tonight?
Hey, Will, I think you may have got dropped. It sounded like you had a pretty bad connection.
You got dropped. Well, listen. Well, anyway, thanks very much, fellas. We really appreciate you coming on the show, and certainly after November, we'll likely have you back. It's great. Thanks very much. We really appreciate it.
Will, thanks for having us.
Not at all, guys. Not at all. Not at all. We'll see you in a few months. Now, at this time, we're going to bring you our Crime Beats Gangster Nickname of the Month segment. Hey, this one is on Arnold the Brain Rothstein. Nothing gave a stronger boost to organized crime in America than Prohibition. The ban on the manufacture and sale of drinking alcohol did nothing to drive the demand for booze. And who started it all was Arnold the Brain Rothstein. What a guy. Brain. What a character. Now,
Right. The Rothstein, who everybody knows, was involved with the big baseball scandal, right? But he also played a big role in organized crime.
Absolutely. He was quite the guy, and it's a good nickname for the guy. Now, just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for April the 19th. Our guests will be filmmakers Al Proffitt and our very own Ron Chapsick, who will discuss their acclaimed documentary film titled Frank Matthews, Part 1. It's the story of the life and criminal career of Frank Matthews, America's biggest kingpin. It's going to be another great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss that one. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First Worldwide Radio Network with Ron Chapsick and yours truly. For all of you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime
by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are, we'd like to thank you for tuning into the broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. On behalf of Ron Chepsik and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Tony.